Welcome back once again to the Mini PC Show. My name is Brian, and this is episode 76. We have with us in the house today, Rich and Door-to-Door Geek. Guys, what's going on? I haven't seen you in a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while. I kind of miss you guys. I miss hanging out with my buddies, my Mini PC buddies.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. There's so much to catch up on.
Yeah, I'll say the only good thing about not doing a show in a couple weeks means I should have then spent less money.
That's true. It's always good to spend less money.
Does that mean you bought us more stuff, Dor?
No, but I did, I think I said last show, I did pre-order the Rock Pro 64 board. I want to say it was $70, $60 or $70, because I did get the one with more RAM on it because, you know, RAM is
better,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, the Rock folk reached out to me. I forwarded you an email from them, right?
Yep.
Yeah, because I did a video on Diet Pie on the Rock 64 and Armbian. And, you know, they commented on the video because I tagged them in the, what is it, Twitter. Yeah, I tagged them in Twitter. They, you know, liked the video and replied back to me and, you know, said nice stuff about us. And I said nice stuff about them. Same thing with the Pine guys. So I've been kind of having, you know, a little bit of a love fest, you know, back and forth, liking the Pine guys. The Pine guys like us. The Diet Pie guys like what we do. I tell them we like what they do.
So how good is support over there with the Pine Group?
I wouldn't know. Never got support.
Interesting.
I'll say when I've asked a question in their forums especially, I've gotten actual responses. And I will say most of the time when I got a response, it was marked as somebody as a moderator, which I believe is much more closely aligned with the company. I will say I haven't had to actually contact anybody in Pine for support, except for I did order one Rock 64 for a friend. And after like 2 weeks, I just sent him an email and said, I don't remember getting a shipping number. And within, I think it was like 4 hours, I did get an email back saying it was about to be shipped. Sorry for the delay, blah, blah, blah. So at least the times I've had to communicate with them, I want to say twice, they responded fairly quickly.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, they're crazy busy with the Rock 64 Pro right now. Every email, they hey, I'm sorry for not getting back to you quicker. They're like, we're absolutely focusing on this. All of our time's taken up by it. And I think that was on a weekend also.
The only reason why I ask is you can really judge a company, how they respond, how quickly they respond, and how they respond, and how they care for your needs. So just was kind of...
Yeah, I'm not going to name names, but there's a company. I like their product, not very happy with their support.
Well, I'll say the only thing that can differentiate companies these days is customer support, because you know, you can try to make things cheaper, but when you make things cheaper, then you actually affect your own bottom line and you affect your own quality. So you got to charge reasonable amounts. And the only way to differentiate yourself is by giving good customer support. I will say my 9-to-5 job in our like tagline is service, customer service. And one of the things that I've tried to communicate with everybody there is we are not only supposed to give good customer service to paying customers that come in the door, but every interaction I have with a coworker is customer service. They are my customer inside of work. So we need to carry that same philosophy forward in all of our interactions.
And that's good. I think that's how it should be.
So I'll give you a smidge of a work story. What I do at work is operations, meaning I lead the operations team for virtualization and, unfortunately, Windows, which is kind of the funniest thing ever. Because I know, you know, only professionally do I touch Windows and as infrequently as possible. But so what happens is engineering does something and then we make it work continuously. And I was talking to somebody, like, our public website had some issues, and that's, you know, you're on a call 24/7 for that if the public website goes down. And so I'm talking to the person that runs the website. I'm like, hey, you know, maybe I can help you out with some things here. He's like, who are you and why are you talking to me? I'm like, whoa. I'm like, you know, I'm operations. I'm head of operations. I just want to make sure if there's, because I've done, you know, large scale websites for companies before. And if there's anything I can do to help you, help it be more stable, you know, blah. And the guy was all defensive until he realized I was on his side and I was trying to help him.
Yeah, I hate to say it, and that shows a culture inside of a company. And I'll say public facing web people seem to get a lot of angst from both sides, because the tech people don't understand why their job is so hard, and then the PR people don't understand why it takes them, in air quotes, so long to do an update.
It's a lot of work behind it.
In the way I'm looking at it, I'm not that I'm not helpful, but realistically, I'm looking at it from a totally selfish way. I don't want to be up at whatever AM or on the phone all weekend because their SQL server blah or their something, whatever else happened.
Yeah, I'll say that's the honest. The reason why I go to patreon.com and support the people I do, I look at it as a very selfish way of preemptively, proactively paying them off, bribing those people to keep creating content.
Well, and like, you're right. And I asked that about the Diet Pie, because I saw, you know, he posted, hey, I'm having, I don't know if it was GoFundMe or one of those sites, but to raise money for a motherboard for his desktop. And I'm like, dude, you got a Patreon? Because I'll send money your way monthly.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they did a GoFundMe. Somebody told them it was what they needed to do, is what I'll say. The good news is they posted the GoFundMe page, and I believe it was funded in less than 36 hours. He was looking for a goal of 210 pounds, I'm guessing is the symbol for it, and he already has 285 out of a mere 12 people.
Yep, that's nice. And I only saw it recently, and I couldn't find my login to support him, but I'll figure that out, and I'll send him some money, because I just want to show my appreciation.
Well, and I will second it. If they do a Patreon, I have no problem whatsoever going in and setting up a monthly contribution. It might not be as quick as a GoFundMe, but I'm sure that the longevity to it would definitely be in their best interest.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I will make sure that in the show notes, there is a link to the GoFundMe. It is still going on. I want to say it said 10 more days are still on it, and I will do everything in my power to actually get this thing posted as soon as possible.
Or you could just retweet it.
Jolly good.
My tweets don't seem to get a lot of interaction, is the way I'll put it.
You mean it's just me?
You, Josh, Sir Kevin McLaughlin, and that's about it.
So can we talk links? Because I see something I'm staring at, and I'm like in love.
Oh, hold on. I want to tell my story first. So,
tell your story, man.
So, yeah, this wasn't a dig at all on NVIDIA. This is a feel-good, happy, joy story. So my NVIDIA Shield TV pooped the bed a couple of days ago. I put it to sleep. I never turn it off. You can turn it off on the remote. I never do. I just let it fall asleep. So I went to, you know, turn it on as usual and watch a little TV. Was not coming on. Black screen. I'm like, oh, what's going on with this thing? My batteries are dead in the remote. So I'm playing around with it. The light is completely dark on the unit. So I'm doing all I can to troubleshooting the power supply, troubleshooting the box. I'm not smelling anything burnt or anything. So I let it sit for a couple of days. I'm like, you know what? Let me call NVIDIA. I know I bought this thing last year. So let's find out and see what they can do. So at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I call NVIDIA and someone answers the phone. I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. So
an actual human answer the phone.
Yes, an actual human being answer the phone. Although she wasn't 100% knowledgeable, but she was willing to help me out, you know, it came down to it. And I said, the power's the unit's bricked. I can't do anything. And she's like, well, when did you buy it? And I said, well, I bought it last year. Well, it's out of warranty, unfortunately, but let me see what we can do for you. And lo and behold, 24 hours later, they're shipping me an RMA device
Wow.
to replace it. And I just, I think the warranty ended in April. So
that's good service.
It is. You know, I'm like, you know what? I just missed the boat. Go figure, right? As soon as something happens, my warranty ends out. And she's like, all right, don't worry about it. We'll take care of you. And just thought that was really good. And not only that, they communicated via email. They actually called me back just to say that we sent you an email and it's coming your way. Just wanted to let you know. And so we're taking care of it. I just thought that was really, really cool. So thumbs up, NVIDIA. Way to go. Good job.
Oh, yeah, because that device was not cheap, even though I do think you got it on sale. It is, as far as I am concerned, a premier device, and the price was not cheap. And the good thing is, I'm sure when it worked, it did pretty much everything you expected it to do just fine. And now that it went away silently in its sleep, at least, you know, you get one, even though it might be refurbished or whatever, you have something that works.
Right. No, I fully agree. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, that's good. That's always good when you get, you know, good tech support.
So what links were you looking at, Rich?
Well, I am a fan of the Nook. You know, if there's a Intel something, whatever, because my home networking lab is, let's see, what version of the Nook? I think it's a Generation 5, but I have a 32 gig Nook i5, and I have a Celeron Nook, which is my data store, and I'm super happy with them. And I've been wanting to upgrade so I could do some more cluster type stuff in my home lab, but I don't think these are the powerful Nooks. So I was taking a look at Link. Which one is it? On line 638. But I think they've released more powerful Nooks, because this is the Gemini Lake. I think, what's the other lake, the newest lake?
Cabby?
Yes, that's Cabby Lake.
Is Cabby the newest lake? I thought I read something.
I believe it was, actually. I could be wrong.
I thought there was like a Cocoon Lake or something like that.
I honestly don't know. I know that's the one I've seen, at least from time to time. I can. I'm old, Rich. Ever since they went off of the P2, P3, P4, I have no idea what's what.
Yeah, I think that's the eighth generation processor.
Mm-hmm.
So line 638, Gemini Lake NUC review, NUC7CJYH. Man, they do horrible with model numbers.
Just rolls right off the tongue. I added this link because I saw a few reviews on the dual core and the quad core device of these Gemini Lake processors for this Nook, and I was really impressed by just by the power you get from the low end. So these processors are on the low end spectrum, like you called out, Rich, but they're more so on the higher end of the low end spectrum. And seeing how they perform I'm drawing a blank with media streamer like Plex, seeing how they perform with Light Gaming, it was pretty cool to see. You know, you didn't get a lot of slowdown, you didn't get a lot of tearing with respect to some of the games. You know, it's not, you know, just expect to play, you know, Grand Theft Auto. Granted that you can, with all the settings throttled way back, you can still get a good experience on it. But pinning this Gemini Lake processor up against the previous processors, you can see the huge difference in between performance. And for the money that you're paying for something like this, for a bare bones model under $200, you know, you supply your own storage, you supply your own memory. And, you know, if you are going to look at something like this, I'd definitely suggest getting the dual memory, because of the dual channel adds a little bit more boost in performance rather than just getting one stick. You know, definitely get the 2 4 gigs. Mm-hmm. But it was really cool to see. And I would actually get the quad core model just for a Plex server alone. I mean, you can't beat the price.
So when you talk Plex server, you're not talking the Plex client, you're talking the actual server?
Yes, the actual server.
All right, so my Plex server at home is my Odroid XU4, and with me on the road is the ROG 64.
So when you're streaming, what kind of streams can you get with that?
Okay, so there's a little more detail to that. Let me talk about the Odroid XU4. I've no problem doing multiple streams from that. And no matter what quality it is. And typically I'm doing better than 1080p as far as quality goes.
And I'm going to guess the Odroid is hardwired into the network.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I think that's a big thing. Also, don't go Wi-Fi on any kind of server on your network unless it's, you know, low bandwidth. The other thing is my Rock 64, you know, and I'm running Plex sonar radar transmission. Do you remember I texted, I Google instant message Dor, F-U, I hate you. Do you remember that, Dor?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I do.
And the reason I did that is because I logged into my Rock 64. I did a shutdown. I said, you know what? I hear Dor saying in my head, back it up. Back up, pull the micro SD card and image it. I pulled the micro SD card. That was the last it ever worked. It's not doing crap. It just totally KO'd. And I'm like, damn it. You know, it was working fine. It was exactly the configuration I wanted. I'm like, that's when you shut it down. Do a graceful shutdown. No, just don't yank the power on it. And, you know, image the card, and the card, you know, decided it was time.
That sucks.
Yeah, it does.
I'll say the Intel NUC, their Gemini Lake. For paying the Intel tax, because there is overhead you have to pay with the Intel proc. So let's just say hypothetically 20% of what you're paying is just for the license fee of saying it's an Intel processor. $120 for that bare bones system is not bad whatsoever, especially when you look at, you can max the RAM out at 16 gigs. Now, I am a glutton when it comes to RAM. Now, on a normal desktop system of any magnitude, if I don't have 16 gigs of RAM, I'm not using that computer. That's just the way it is. I need all the RAM I can get.
And I'm going to jump in. System 76 came out with what looks like MacBook Pro-ish type machine, 32 gigs of RAM.
Well, wow. A little bit clunkier than a MacBook, I'll say that. That NUC form factor is very nice. It is truly portable, yet you can also use it as a real desktop. If you want the convenience, because that's what, to me, the reason to go Intel on any of these devices is for the convenience factor of knowing exactly what to expect, because anything you can do on a desktop or a laptop, you can do on this device as well. Any operating system you can install on your desktop or your laptop, you can install as well. That's the convenience you get with an Intel processor. And $129 for that base model is not bad. If you don't mind paying the money for the RAM, which I wouldn't be willing at all, and the drive, the hard drive, the good thing about the hard drive is you pick your own hard drive. So you can go out and you can get a literal like 40 gig SSD for nickels. And then when you want to, you can then upgrade it to a better, faster, bigger drive. For like somebody's first mini computing experience, if they want travel actual computer, it is still hard to beat the form factor of the NUC.
Oh, and you know what? I mean, even if you're doing the hotel warrior like I've been doing, is you could take the NUC, you could get a wireless keyboard mouse for like $20 on Amazon. I've got, let's see, it's a Logitech that I paid right around $20 for, and I'm liking it. And drop those in your roller bag, and you plug that into the hotel monitor, you know, with the HDMI output, and boom, you're good to go. So I'm kind of eyeing, you know, I'll drop the Amazon link to your Dor so you can put this in the notes. But this is a little way over expensive because of a couple of things. The way the NUC goes, it's NUC and then what generation the NUC is. So this is the NUC 7, it's 7th generation NUC. And then the next characters are going to be what the CPU is. This is the i7. It's not there was the whatever Canyon, Hades Canyon, and there's a couple of which isn't the same form factor. So this is the regular square box, just like the Celeron NUC is. But it includes Windows 10. If you get it outfitted with a 1 terabyte SSD and 32 gigs of RAM, it comes in at $1,249. So the good and the bad about that is, you're paying for the Windows 10, I believe, Also, if you're not going to, if you're just going to use it as headless computing like I do, you're paying a lot of money for the Thunderbolt outputs that you're not going to be using. So this would be, and it's 4K HDMI, the whole shoot match. So that's kind of the negative end of what right now my lab has an i5, which is really nice. I'm very happy with. So I think I might go i5 in the future as opposed to going i7 because I don't need to pay for all the graphics capabilities.
Well, that's definitely a good call. Does it support HDR? I know this the Gemini Lake does not support HDR, but it does support 4K.
Let me drop you the link. I don't see HDR right away. Indoor, if you're getting the smaller one, here's the other thing that I like. USB 3.0 is super fast, and you get external USB 3.0 drives super cheap.
I agree. I'm becoming more a fan of USB 3, less desiring eSATA or SATA connectors for drives. The only thing about USB 3 that I like to know before I buy is I want there to be a single disk inside of whatever device I'm buying. It seems like when there's multiple disks involved, they use some sort of firmware to like RAID or JBOD the two drives together, which can make data recovery troublesome for someone with my lack of skills.
Excellent point on that. Yeah, you want a single disk in there. And some people, what was it, the 8-terabyte data center disk was included. They told you how to, there's some YouTube videos on this. They're actually, if you bought the 8-terabyte data center disk, which is the Western Digital Red, you'd pay more money for the bare drive than it in that enclosure. And they're telling like how to figure out which one it was and how to shuck it to get it out if you needed it for, you know, a machine.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah, I think with like a certain lot or serial number set, it was.
Right.
Another thing, we've seen this quite a bit with the Raspberry Pi, is they tend to have the shared bus with the USB and the hard drive as well, too. And I noticed that with the Cabby Lake Canyon Nook. I can't remember which specific model. I think it was the Core i5 one. The FireWire. I'm dating myself with the FireWire. USB 3.1 connector has a shared bus with the hard drive. So although you do get the speeds, but if you were to use like an external video adapter that NVIDIA makes, you might not. You know, you'll definitely get more performance than you would with the built-in graphics processor, but you're probably better off, you know, buying a gaming rig at that point as far as the price is concerned and the performance that you're going to get from it.
So, yeah, I'm just looked it up because I bought it on Amazon. So the Nook that I have is the Gen 6 i5, and it was bare bones. It was $399, but this is... It's a quad core something. I got to look up the CPU. Anyhow, I'm not easily finding it on the site here.
Ah, that's okay. So, Dor, do you remember a while back when we first started the mini PC show, you had posed the question, so what is a mini PC to you?
Yeah, it was like, how do you define a mini PC? Because I don't think there is any one way. It's like asking somebody, what does it mean to be patriotic. I think we all have our own ideas.
Exactly. And quite honestly, I mean, we could talk about phones, tablets, laptops, computers for your vehicle. The reason why I'm bringing this up is I actually put on here the Oculus Go. Now, you guys know me. I'm a big VR fan. I like VR. I can't afford to be a raging VR fan. I can only... get the experience for my phone, but I actually had a little bit of extra points left over on my credit card here, and I put some cash down on the Oculus Go just to see what it was like not being able to use my phone for VR, and I was really impressed by the quality, the lenses, the visual range that you get on the device itself, and it's just the overall experience of it. I mean, I was pretty blown away by what you get for $200. I mean, I just can't believe it.
Yeah, I'll say 200 is approaching a normal price. Sub 3 is when you start to get into more normal people prices. So 200 ain't too bad. My question is, what is this? What does this not have versus the full blown Oculus? Do you know?
So it doesn't have any tracking. So it doesn't track you in space. So you can't move forward, backward, or side to side. And I believe the lenses actually in this on the Go model, I believe the lenses are a little bit better than the original Oculus. But the gotcha that I found is that with my phone, obviously with the, I have a Samsung S8, so that uses an OLED display, and Samsung is really good with their displays. So when you're using that with the VR gear, the image is really good. Now, if you don't bog your phone down with a lot of apps and things like that, the quality is really good. The image is really good. You get your deep blacks and you know, your bright whites. So the colors are really awesome. But with the Oculus Go, they're using an LCD display. And I noticed right off the bat when I slid it on, the LCD panel, when you your darks aren't really dark. They're kind of like a grayish color. Not really gray, but a dark gray. So you could clearly see, you know, the quality difference of the from the OLED display. Now, if they were to go with the OLED, I think it would have been like 10 out of 10 rather than, you know, the 9 out of 10 or the 8.1 out of 10 from a scale to 1 to 10.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I would be okay with that. I don't have to have perfect blacks on my images to be encapsulated in what I'm seeing, is what I'll say. So if it doesn't do the tracking, instead I'm going to guess the controls are more in the joystick itself. When you want to turn, you use that to turn?
No, when you can you have your 360 degree vision, so you can move your head up, down, side to side. You can actually turn in a circle and you can move around through space that way, but you can't move forward, backwards, or up and down. So you can't crouch down to the ground and pick something up and get really close to the image. Whereas with whereas with the Rift, it does have some tracking ability for that, as well as the HTC Vive too, as well. But you know, you're paying for that. I believe Lenovo launched a standalone VR headset, which is an Android product, and that does do tracking without any external devices. You know, they have to set up. It does everything on the actual headset, but that you're looking at about $400 or more.
Yeah, the starting price for that was $400. The plus, their sales pitch to that one is you don't need a phone.
Right, and it makes a huge difference, though.
Well, and I heard some journalist try to say, I don't want to use my phone for that because then when I get a notification, it will take me out of it. Mute your notifications. It ain't difficult. This isn't rocket science. I'm pretty sure 6-year-olds know how to mute notifications on iPads.
You know, I never had an issue with that. Usually, I don't recall like getting any notifications when I'm using my Gear VR.
Yeah, and I mean, I am a fan of Lenovo, period. I like them. I like them a lot. Everybody makes products that aren't great. I'll say that. The ThinkPads are great. The IdeaPads, maybe not as great. This headset, I believe, is probably of perfectly fine quality. I'm sure if I would spend $400 on it, I would say after some length of time, $400 is a bit much for the device. That's just me personally. I could much, much, much quicker let go of $200 instead of seeing jet blacks, see dark shades of gray, and instead of having the complete head tracking, at least have 360 gyroscope tracking on the $200 Oculus Go.
I fully agree with you on that one. I thought the Lenovo was a bit overpriced as well, too. But if you've never tried VR, I would say, and if you don't, you know, have a smartphone that's capable of doing the VR, then the Oculus Go is a really good buy.
And if you go to the website, there is a place at the bottom where you can put in your zip code and it will tell you where you can go and try out a demo of it if you want to try before you buy, which can't hurt.
Amen.
I will talk about just one thing really quick, line 655. The only reason I'm talking about this is because I like competition. I'm a big fan of making other companies do better out of pressure. And this was one of the things that I saw that I really liked. Vivaldi browser is technically being built on the Chromium engine. So it is a derivative of Chrome. Think of it as a cousin of the Chrome browser. But I will say it has great features, much better features than, to me, Firefox or Chrome. Speed-wise, it's fine. I'm not the guy who does browser benchmarking speed tests to figure out which browser is going to give me the best performance overall. I go off of how do I feel when I'm using the browser. They have a couple features in this browser that I really like. One of them is called panels, where, like, for instance, if I were to take a panel and add my Gmail to that panel, it would put it on the side in a collapsible format, but it would also be its mobile pages. So it will automatically know in this side panel show the mobile version of it. Well, Vivaldi, I could never install on any ARM platform I had because I always just tried to do a apt install Vivaldi or what, and I couldn't do it. Well, it turns out now Vivaldi has made a version for the Raspberry Pi, which gives me hope that I will be able to install it on non-Raspberry Pi operating systems. More than likely, if it's a derivative of Debian, I should still be able to install it because with the Debian package format, the dependency resolution should at least try to go install everything else that it needs. I have had a chance to do it because literally I nuked and paved my Rock 64 just last night, I want to say. I went from Debian testing Armbian to the full-blown stable version, and I gotta say, running Chromium browser on Armbian is nearly, if not twice as fast as running the standard Ubuntu Mate and Firefox browser. And I'll say this, on Firefox on Ubuntu Mate, when stuff didn't go right, the complete OS would just crash and the screen would go blank and then nothing would happen. I had that happen a couple times. On Chromium inside of Armbian, when a browser tab goes ballistic, it only crashes that one tab. I click reload and then it works fine again. Vivaldi, I'm going to basically try and I'm going to see if I can get similar results with, because right now it is my go-to browser when all else fails.
I got to say, I don't think I've heard of this browser before. I feel like I'm getting schooled right now. Thank you.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like, when somebody asks me what browser do I run, I typically then answer for what use case. Because on my desktops, I typically have Firefox, Chrome, Brave, Vivaldi, all loaded, because they all have different use cases. When I do Google Hangouts, I use Chrome. You know, when I'm doing my standard workflow, I use Vivaldi. When I do presentation for OBS, I use Brave. And for all for different reasons. And at work, I specifically have different browsers loaded because, dare I say, some of the JSP pages we have, JavaScript pages, only run right in certain browsers. SharePoint only runs right in certain browsers. And then, you know, so it's always that case. Vivaldi seems to be the middle of the road. It seems to run everything good enough that I need to use it. And the panels are the thing I would definitely encourage people to check out.
I'm surprised Opera didn't make that list.
Well, wait, didn't the Vivaldi guys do Opera?
Yes and no. The Vivaldi guys used to work at Opera.
Right.
And they left. I don't ever trust Opera for 7 years now because they unannounced would pipe information through their servers in the name of security. They would say, we would do this for security, or we will do this to increase your performance, increase your speed. It was one of those things. I do think they had the best of intentions, but they weren't transparent enough for me, so I really didn't support them too much.
Uh-huh.
You know, everybody has to be picky about something. So once in a while, I'm picky about that.
No, it's better than just sand. I don't like it because they use different color blues than what I like. Right. There's a real reason behind it. So that's good.
Do you work at my job, Brian? Because I hear that all the time.
Oh, dude, I did a complete like software, you know, change on something. And I got that commentary. It's like, oh, yeah, the blue's much better than the gray. I'm like, oh, I just wanted to cry.
I work so hard.
It's not the performance. It's not this. It's, oh, yeah, yeah, the blue we like much better.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. Here, guys, I wanted to talk about this because we did talk about a little bit last episode about Microsoft Azure Sphere. And then on line 652, first, quick review. Azure Sphere offered custom chip diagrams up to anybody to make these custom processors, these custom chips to handle Azure Sphere IoT devices. And along with that free chip design they gave out, that chip would then connect to Microsoft Azure services for all security updates, free security updates for 10 years. Which to me was a genius marketing move for Microsoft and will ensure their place in IoT for at least some length of time. Thus, I hate them and I don't like that. I want competition. Nobody else was offering anything remotely close to that level of service. Well, thankfully, days later, Android announced Android Things 1.0. Google promises 3 years of updates for every device. 3 years is good, but 3 years is not 10 years. So I'm happy they're doing something, but this is not good enough. They're going to have to offer more than that. The thing I like about Google is they're offering you to connect to your servers for a lot of things, and they say they're only going to be delivering security updates, where Microsoft Azure, I'm sure, is going to be doing a lot of metadata tracking and data gathering.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is really good, but it really pays off when you have a really good, strong, and I hate to say this buzzword, AI, some kind of machine learning that really knows how to deal with the big data.
Well, I'll say, if the federal government is any indicator, you don't need to know what to do with big data. All you need is server farms and data warehouses to store that data. You'll figure out what to do with the data later on. It's money. And I will say now, upstart companies are having a difficult time explaining themselves to venture capitalists, is the latest thing I've been hearing. They're having a hard time explaining to them what they're doing with the data, why they're doing with the data, how are they storing the data securely, what kind of promises can you give us about this data moving forward? Because in the past, it used to be expensive to store data. Not anymore. It is incredibly cheap to store data. It used to be really difficult to transmit all that data so you can do all the tracking. These days, it's easy to transmit data. And with 5G coming, it's going to be even easier to transmit data. So it sounds like the VCs are trying to insist that these new upstart companies have some sort of long-term plan about how you're going to secure the data, what data is going to get protected, what data is going to get anonymized, what data is going to be shared, what data is going to be sold, and what data is going to be used for advertising. So I hope what I'm hearing is right, and I hope companies that are coming up are going to have to make this a priority in their long-term business plan and not just say, we're tracking people.
Oh, you make a good point. Rich, were you going to say something?
No, I was actually looking at some other links.
Oh, I saw you looking at it. I thought you were going to chime in. I kudos to Microsoft, man. That's 10 years is long enough to make you think, oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, that they're doing that. That's really cool. But the 3 years is like, now, do I need to get another device because it's not secure? That like you have to spend more money.
All right, right. And here's the other huge bleeping delete expletive letdown. Okay, so as it turns out, Google is not making Android for the Raspberry Pi. little tangent, because they can't, okay? It's only a gig of RAM. You can't have Android running on a gig of RAM. Stop looking for it. Stop asking for it. Stop inquiring about it. It ain't going to happen. But Android things, in air quotes, they're going to make for the Raspberry Pi. Android things to an end user, think of it as a siloed version of Android that's really only made to run one thing. So hypothetically, you can have your Android things enabled smart mirror running a calendaring type thing in the background. So it will run that calendaring thing. You won't be able to install other applications on it like standard Android, only Android things dedicated. So it's almost like putting your phone in super battery saving mode, where you're extremely limiting the functionality of the device. Now, with that said, no developer voluntarily in the history of computing will move towards a ecosystem of certain flexibility to an ecosystem of less flexibility. It doesn't happen. So to expect developers to jump from Android to Android things, I think is almost a death wish and a suicide watch, because I don't think without really hard, proper motivation, anybody is going to move to this platform unless there's unbelievable benefits. 3 years of updates are not unbelievable benefits. We already have 2 years of updates from the date of development with normal Android devices. So it's only one more year of security updates. And then, tangent, why? Devices in America aren't getting exploited. Where are they? They're happening in third world countries where people load third party insecure stores or places to go to get software. It isn't happening in America. So I don't see this Android things news doing anything to move the KPI, the key performance indicator of this Android thing heartbeat, any more than Android TV becoming more real or becoming more popular. I don't see either of those things moving at all. So they did a Google I/O talk about it. That means nothing. I think Android things is going to be a very small thing that they do a little bit of stuff with, and I'm pretty sure in a year or two it's basically going to die.
That's really depressing. I think the only, well, not the only thing, but one of the things that could move the needle is cash talks. You know, let's put some money behind it. Let's put some cash into the developers' pockets and make it profitable.
Well, and I hate to say it, like we had Nexus devices, we had Pixel devices. That was Google saying, here's how to do hardware. Here's how hardware can look. Here's how to put this thing together. With Android things, I'm not seeing any of that. I'm not seeing, here's how to do a desk clock. Here's how to do a wall calendar. Here's how to do an intercom device. I'm not seeing any of that from anybody in Google. And if they think people with Raspberry Pis alone are going to do enough to make this worthwhile, they're on narcotic drugs, because Raspberry Pis are breaking through in third world country school systems, not yuppie playground high-rise penthouse IoT devices.
No, not at all. From what I took away from that is that manufacturers now could make devices that are generally dumb a lot smarter with the Android things. That's the takeaway that I got from it. So if I were to buy a new ceiling fan, instead of getting an adapter to go with that ceiling fan, or have that company X do this special thing and have a hub and make it work with my Alexa, now they can use Android things and build it right into the device. And it's pretty much compatible with all of the devices that you purchase.
So I'll tell you what I'm aggravated with the ceiling fans on is I did some home automation with a Raspberry Pi and a 433 megahertz outlets, and I got them working. So there's a transmitter receiver that for $10 that you can plug into the Raspberry Pi for 433 megahertz. I wasn't able to sniff, like the ceiling fans are all 433 megahertz. I wasn't able to sniff the codes because I figured, oh, okay, you know, I got the outlets onto the fans and lights, because the fan module controls the fan and the light, forward, reverse, and the speed settings. Like, now I'm going to be king of the world because I can, you know, spin up the fans. I can turn the... Couldn't figure it out. Couldn't get it to work. And I was really bummed about that. And I'll tell you, do you know what drives me crazy is, do any of you have like a bedside clock radio? No.
No, sir. I have Alexa, which I probably shouldn't, but I do.
Okay.
Well, I have a wife who has a clock sitting next to her.
If you have one of those clock AM FM radios, it is still 1970s technology inside. It's not an RTL, you know, a software-defined radio on a chip. It's that. It's not a phase lock loop, you know, a synthesized tuner. It's that crappy crystal tuner from 1970 in discrete components. I couldn't believe it because, you know, somebody got me a radio as a gift and I'm tuning in the frequency. I'm like, this isn't even PLL. I didn't even have to open it up to know that. And I'm going off on that tangent, that rat hole, because how easy would it be to make your ceiling fan Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or whatever? There's so many devices out there that are, you know, have Wi-Fi built into them that are like $5 that you could just wire that into the system. And you could make it, whether it's Google Home or Alexa or, you know, you could just, I just wish everything was open, that there was an open platform. And I saw an article that they're going to be, there's a standard for open mesh networking. So it's not a branded mesh network. It's not like the Asus AI mesh, which I love. And I've done a couple of videos on, so go to flyingrich.com to see that.
Bing.
I'm going to keep talking till Dora makes an unhappy face.
Okay. Well, I'll say I did see the links for that open mesh. I haven't got a chance to read any of it yet. I hope it becomes real, but I'll say this.
I hope so, yeah.
But also really quick, Android things versus Microsoft Azure Sphere. There's more differences in play that is hard to find unless you actually read all the articles. And God, I didn't read them. I used Say It on Android, so I listened to them. So I didn't read them. But there is a size thing. And if size matters, this is going to play a key role. Android Thing boards are much, much, much bigger than Azure Sphere boards because all Azure Sphere is basically the chip. Those boards, they said, can be as small as, I want to say it was like 5 centimeters by 5 centimeters. It was small, where the Android Things board, all the components were separate on the board, so the boards were literally like 4 to 5 times bigger. So if size does matter, that's going to play a key role in when me, a manufacturer, decides to go for an IoT thing. If I can get smaller boards and 10 years of support, and if it's cheaper to make because it's smaller, which sometimes is the case, then it's going to be Microsoft's Sphere all the way. If size doesn't matter and you're doing something in a wall unit and it's cheaper to go Android Things, then I could see people going towards it. But when I think IoT, I don't think bulky items. I think small items, especially small items that hopefully don't generate a lot of heat. And Azure Sphere in the spec was fanless cooling all around. So if size is going to play a role, I can see that being a definite thing that's going to drive companies to making their decision. So I don't know where we're going to be in a year or 2 years from now, but I know in 3 years from now, Android Things 1.0 things will be dropping support, aka becoming extremely insecure. So if I'm a company, even though I hate Microsoft, I would probably go with Azure Sphere unless I have a direct hard reason not to.
Good point.
Yeah, that is a really good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, because your product life cycle, you're always anticipating it, you'll deliver sooner than you actually do. And you may be delivering just as it's getting orphaned.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure some companies want planned obsolescence, thus giving you a reason to upgrade. But at the same token, the number of IP addresses every tech professional knows is going to skyrocket. So the number of devices you're going to have is only going to increase. So the need to replace items shouldn't be as much, I would think. So, I can see simple IoT devices literally being around for 10 years in a house, because like your alarm clock or like your intercom system, I don't see a need to upgrade them anytime soon when you get the latest and greatest.
Now, that's a good point too, again, Dor. I was just about to say that. I mean, when I think of IoT, that you know, when I buy something like that, whether it be a small plug unit or a toaster or whatever, I'm not going to keep buying it every 3 years. You know, it's going to last as long as the unit will last for. And if that's 10 years, then hey, that's 10 years. I'm not going to go out and buy another one. But if it was modular, pay attention, manufacturers, then it'd be a different story.
I agree. Is there any other notes you guys wanted to bring up?
Yeah, actually, there are two. And one was, hold on, let me look at the line. It was the interview on the Raspberry Pi, line 640. Continued answers to your questions for Eben Upton. And I'm highly disappointed. Dor, I don't know if you posted this a while back onto the list, but it's like, hey, what about the Raspberry Pi 4? And he's like, there obviously will be a Raspberry Pi 4, but it doesn't say anything I want to hear.
What do you want to hear?
Well, it says, you know, we'll announce specs, I'm hoping, early autumn. And so my must-have on a Pi device is going to be USB 3, gigabit Ethernet. I'm okay with 2.4 gigahertz. If they went 5 on the Wi-Fi, I'd be okay with that. But more RAM, you know, they got to go above the gig on the RAM. They got to go, you know, 2 gig, 4 gig. And definitely the USB 3.0 and gigabit Ethernet. Those are the big items. That's, you know, that's why I'm loving on the Odroid XU4 and the ROC chip 64.
I think the Raspberry Pi is so big at this point that they could even do like a tiered structure model and have,
sure,
you know, different versions.
But so here's my point on, you know, the Odroid XU4 is a little more costly. I think it's the drivers, etc., and OSs are mature for it, so it's working very well. The Pine, I keep wanting to say Pine 64, but it's the ROC chip 64 by Pine. I don't think the drivers and software are mature for it, but I think it's going to be a kick-ass machine when it does. But they're kicking that out the door at $25, $35, and $45 with 1 gig, 2 gig, and 4 gig. So for the same Raspberry Pi dollar, you're getting a 2 gigs of RAM, gigabit Ethernet, USB 3.0. My only caveat, and I dropped that on the bottom of the link list here because I saw there was another link about cooling for the ROC chip 64 board, is I've got a dual fan setup that I purchased that I'm liking. I haven't done, you know, super hot study, scientific study, but it is working good. My only quip about it is you got to have it resting on something soft, because eventually two fans running together will develop harmonics at some point. So you don't want it firmly mounted. Otherwise, you're going to get like a zzz, zzz, like that going on.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I'll just say an Eben Q&A session is nothing like an Elon Musk conference call. At least he's entertaining.
Yeah, there's not a lot of red meat in that.
Yeah, this guy is not entertaining whatsoever. I would honestly encourage he hires a PR guy or a community guy or a media guy.
Somebody to write jokes for him.
Something. All of the questions were extreme. They were obviously filtered questions. They were obviously questions he wanted to answer. And the ones that he did answer, for the most part, were fluff-filled. There weren't really any meat on the bones, from what I could tell. We all know there's going to be a new Raspberry Pi, period. We all know there's going to be one. Either the goal is going to be future third world growth or hobbyist in first world country. It's getting to me harder and harder and harder to bridge that gap and make it both at the same time with boards like the ROC 64, with the ROC Pro 64, with the Odroids coming out. I think it's going to be harder and harder for them to keep their grip. With that said, as long as they have the name recognition, they're going to have the name recognition. They're going to be the clear winner in the popularity contest But the popularity contest is not a test of quality. It's just a popularity contest. There is, if you want to watch the YouTube of the Q&A, you can. I watched like 2 minutes of it and I just stopped watching it. Whenever the next Raspberry Pi comes out, I'm going to pay attention to it. I'm going to need a legitimate reason to buy it. I'm not just going to buy it to buy it. I have plenty of mini computers now. Of course, unless I go to another conference to give them away again. I have plenty of mini computers for now. I don't need any more for any explicit things. One question, can you go smaller than the Zero? Why, yes. Just take a look at the Nano Pi Neo and boards like that. It's half the size of a Raspberry Pi Zero. So these questions were from people who, I will say in the nicest way, are extremely undereducated on what a mini computer is or can be.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't enthusiasts. It wasn't in, not a lot of meat on the bone, not a lot of enthusiast interaction.
I got to watch this video on this interview. I know it's probably pretty dry, but I'm still kind of curious on what direction this foundation is trying to hit. Like you said, Dor, are they shooting for, third world country? Are they shooting for hobbyists? Are they shooting for, a different market? But when I talk to IT professionals and I say, oh, Raspberry Pi, I bring the Raspberry Pi up, they know what I'm talking about. If I mention a Nodroid, they're scratching their head. What is that? Is that something, mm-hmm. So the Raspberry Pi Foundation is there. They have the muscle to put out pretty much anything they want at this point. It doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. They could do a wide variety of things.
Oh yeah, I mean, seriously, there could be a weekly television show, a half an hour weekly network television show called Raspberry Pi. And every week they take you someplace else and show you what somebody else is doing with the Raspberry Pi. There's enough out there for it. And they're not doing any of the PR push to try to push the name further into the ecosystem. I mean, I know secondhand experience. In third world countries, they're making a difference. They're making a damn big difference.
That's exciting.
But yeah, it isn't getting out there. The normal people don't know about it. I would like it if more normal people would know, not only is this little board inside of this battle bot where it's going back and forth across stages, but no, it's also over here in this country building up school infrastructure. To me, they need to do much better PR, and I don't care if it's sponsored by whoever, Broadcom, anybody. They need to do a much better job with publicity, because then everything else will follow.
Amen.
So you said two links, Rich. What was the other link you were talking about?
Well, actually, line 660, you got a nice case there. So again, giving out the Rock 64 love, this is a Thingiverse link for a 3D printed case, and it'll mount a 2.5-inch drive and the USB to SATA adapter. So you could use that as an own cloud, anything that you need a hard drive for that you're going to be storing stuff on. It is a laptop type drive. So kind of a neat implementation somebody did. They got the heat sinks, the fan in there, so some good pictures.
Yeah, when I take a look at the processor on my Rock 64, it looks like maybe running the normal Ubuntu Mate and having the browser go completely ballistic, it looks like it almost cooked the chip a little bit. The text is a little bit hard to read.
Serious? Wow.
Well, I have two Rock 64s. On the one running here where I always have it running, it's fine. I can read the chip just fine, but the one I take back and forth to work, the one I really put through the ringer, it's literally discolored. So I was thinking I need to have more cooling in place, and I saw this. The only reason I bookmarked it, because it looked like it was well documented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not only a case, not only a fan, but also a little readout action going on. Yep. So I'm going to look at this and see if it's something that I might be able to do without burning the house down. But there's no guarantees.
What's the readout display for? Is that power or is that adjustable?
Looks like voltage.
I'm pretty sure it's customizable. The only question is how customizable. I'm fine with it showing voltage as long as it shows something.
Right. No, it is a damn good pretty case.
So Are you running heat sinks on your Rock 64 that you take with you?
No.
Yeah, if you got a Rock 64, at minimum heat sinks. I threw a link in there. I got that dual fan setup running on mine, and so far I'm reasonably happy with it. It's $12. It's a heat sink and fans, and it's actually designed for the Raspberry Pi 3, but it fits nicely on top of this, and I've been using it for a while. I would say if you're not sure about doing something, run the CPU command that gives you the temperatures so you know what's going on. And I do that when I install an OS, and like if I'm going to be doing Plex on it, which can be fairly hard on the CPU and GPU, I want to take a look at the temperatures so I know what's going on, and that's why I decided on the Rock 64 that I definitely need active cooling. Heat sinks aren't good enough.
Yeah, it's one of those things I've been meaning to buy something, and then, it's time to leave work and I forget about it. So I will. It's just a question of when. And
do I need to send you a $12 fanny thingy?
No. Fanny thingy? I hope not.
The fan heat sink combo that I'm using?
Oh, no. I'll buy it. I'm right now doing the Podnuts thing, trying to figure out what's the next conference I can go to. Should I pay the embroidery thing, try to get new hats made that the text will hopefully line up better, and looking at doing another round of sponsoring other podcasts to spread the word about the network.
Uh-huh. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm trying to get home for the Memorial Day weekend, and then like the weekend after that is Southeast Linux Fest, and they want to have a Tilts reunion, and they want all of the Tilts cast to be there. I'm like, yeah, that's going to be a rough one for me to make.
Yeah, I, being a Mideasterner, I don't voluntarily on my own travel hotter regions in the summertime. It's plenty hot enough here. Family events, I have no choice in that. I'm like the third person to make a choice in that. So I'm not going to self. I will say that I have no desire to be in hotter regions in the middle of the summertime. I will say Memorial Day is only a couple weeks away, Rich.
Yep. Yeah, I'm trying to get authorization to work a week remote so I can drive down and back. It's only 19 hours each way.
Road trip.
So do you guys have any more links you wanted to bring to the show?
Just I've done a couple of videos, so if you take a look at my website, flyingrich.com, I've done James Middendorf walked me through setting up RaspPPX on the Raspberry Pi, and I've got that running on the Raspberry Pi Zero, which is pretty cool. And can I talk about a giveaway I'm doing?
Yeah, but first, what the hell is RaspPPX?
Oh, okay. You know what? I talked about that on another podcast. RaspPPX is free PBX, and it's asterisk, and is designed to run on a Raspberry Pi. I originally had it running on the Raspberry Pi 3, and just for the heck of it, I threw it on the Raspberry Pi Zero, and I threw two soft clients, one on each of my cell phones kicking around here. And I actually, and hooked it up to Google Voice. So Google Voice is my trunk. So everything here is free, free, free. I made two outgoing phone calls, and the Raspberry Pi Zero W didn't go over 36% CPU.
That's
really good.
Pretty cool. I actually did the same thing, Rich. It is pretty cool to do. And that's not that hard either.
I had a little bit of struggle. James Middendorf, he did a video on how to do it, and I posted that on my site also and threw a link back to his YouTube site. And I did post a little bit of a YouTube video. It's going to be coming out Saturday on the RaspPPX and the performance. And I just showed the phone calls being made, which I didn't know you could make two phone calls simultaneously out of Google Voice.
I didn't know that either. That is pretty cool. So I wonder, can you have two Google Voice numbers? I got to try that out of the same PBX.
I mean, you'd have to add an additional trunk. There's ways to add other trunks. I don't know if you can add two of the same trunk.
I see what you're saying. But yes, that's a really good way to add phone service to your house if you have Google Voice without paying Comcast or whoever that you have with a phone provider with. Nowadays, people have cell phones, but it's always good to have a landline.
So, okay, there's a multi-step process here, and I have Vonage, so it's $18 a month. You can port your Vonage to like T-Mobile or another carrier and then port that to Google Voice. And my goal is to have either a logic problem or whatever. So you call the Hughes Compound Southern Command and it'll ask you add two and two, or if you ask, if you put, you know, yellow and red together, what color do you get? Something like that. And if not, it sends you to the Jolly Roger phone company. That's the one where it talks to you and it keeps the telemarketer on the line.
That's
and
a good one.
I can have extensions. You know, you can have extensions, mailboxes, etc. Or I could have it forward to my cell phone. So you could do a bunch of things like that, which I'm pretty excited about. Now, the other thing that you could do is you could travel with it. Or two things. You could install it at the Hughes Compound Southern Command and just VPN into it on your phone. And so you're always connected to it. Or you could bring it with you wherever you go, as long as you have an internet connection.
Well, the dumb question I would have is, can you whitelist phone numbers in the PBX to not have to go through that? The only reason I say that is spousal approval. So if her relatives call or she calls the house, she doesn't have to go through that.
Yeah, I guess you could. I haven't done any asterisk coding. So I'll have to look into that. But there are asterisk scripts out there for all sorts of things. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, the free PBX is loaded with all sorts of extras that you can actually purchase. Some are free. And I mean loaded. So there's a lot you can do.
Gotcha. I will say there was another Diet Pie update, Rich, but I can't remember what the hell it was. Besides the GoFundMe, there was something else that happened. I can't remember what it was now.
Well, they're at 6.8 right now. They keep updating. They're like rapid updating.
Gotcha. I can't think of anything else I needed to talk about. Did you guys have anything?
Well, I'm going to be doing a contest and a giveaway, and I haven't formulated what that is yet, but it'll be posted on a video. I did the hacking of the Asus T-Mobile AC1900 routers, and I'm going to be doing a new video on how to hack it with the current process, and I'm going to be giving the two routers away once I update them and get the AI mesh working between them.
Very cool. Okay, Brian, if people wanted to catch up with you, what's the easiest way?
Head on over to the Google Plus community, shoot me a hello, or send us an email, or send me an email.
Rich, what's the best way for them to catch up with you?
And that's flyingrich.com. So just go there. That's where my videos and social media is posted.
And if anybody wants to support this podcast, you can either go to patreon.com/minipcshow. You can go to podnuts.com, or you can just share out links into your social feeds of the shows when they go live. If you want to send us a email, just send it to minipcshow@podnuts.com, or you can send us a voicemail at 707-6-PODNUT. If there are any topics you would like us to discuss and you would rather have chat-like talks, you can just send me an email. I can send you an invite to either the Mattermost server or the Discord server. I'll let you guys pick which one you want to be a part of. And with that, we will talk to everyone in about a week.
This is Martin from Podnuts Pro. Thank you so much for choosing this podcast to be in your ears right now. Don't forget to support all the other Podnuts shows on the Podnuts Network. And we cannot do this without you. So please, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, email us at podnutspro@podnuts.com.